AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 76 for October 21st, 2010. Off the grid, John. Off the grid. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. And back in the studio again for AutoLine After Hours, and joining us as always, joining with me my co-hosts, the Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
John, I'm the official king of Twitter Nation for at least 5 minutes.
Did you say that in 140 characters or less?
I don't know, but I did my whole column in tweet speak.
In fact, I want to come back to that in a second, but we also have to welcome Frank Marcus from Motor Trend Magazine here with us tonight, too.
Not even the court jester of Twitterdom.
So how you doing, Frank?
Never been better.
Well, that's great to hear. But let's go back to Peter's column, because that was pretty interesting. You picked a bunch of different topics to write about, and then a la Twitter, you wrote some sort of comments about it for 140, with 140 or fewer characters.
So kind of the state of the auto biz right now.
Right.
And all the different brands. It started out some advertising stuff, and it was fun to do, but boy, I don't want to do it again.
Why?
Well, it was just because I knew that the Twitter Nation would be monitoring to make sure.
That it's 140 or less.
Or less. So, boy, I'll tell you, you got to really... to say something, but it was fun. I enjoyed doing it.
It was a fun column to read. It really was.
Did you abbreviate YOU as you and all that kind of thing, too?
No, I really...
It was English?
Yes.
It was English, and for the most part, pretty much full sentences, too, or at least coherent, complete thoughts.
Yeah. That's almost enough to get you kicked out of Twitter.
Believe me, I know my run is over as we speak, so short-lived.
So, Frank, you guys have been driving cars this week for...
Oh, my gosh. It's been lots of car driving. That was actually a little while ago, Car of the Year. We've got SUV of the Year and Car of the Year under our belts. We've already announced SUV of the Year, of course, as the Cayenne.
Of course, the Cayenne.
Yeah. I've been reading the comments on that, about half of which...
Cayenne hybrid?
It's the whole line. We tested... we had an S on hand to drive, and then we got a turbo in to test... You know, after the fact, we got those two. But, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it does start at $47,000. All right, it's probably going to be hard to find one for $47,000. But, you know, the bandwidth, you know, I think I figured out if you ticked all the boxes, you could spend $168 on one of those.
And a turbo.
Yeah, but you don't really have to. And they've done an awful lot of really neat things. And the number of powertrains they offer and everything, I mean, it's, you know... The Grand Cherokee here, which, you know, is also a pretty impressive, has nowhere near the breadth of the market covered as this niche vehicle, you know.
Right. So, well, at $168,000, you can afford to do a few more.
Well, but at 47 also, of course, and because they're piggybacked with Touareg and whatever, they can get away with stuff like that. But, yeah, no, that was one fair and square. It wasn't even really terribly close.
I've been driving a bunch of cars this week, too, for North American Car of the Year, and I drove the Touareg Hybrid. And all I could think of as I'm driving around on these roads is, man, I would much rather have a diesel. It drives way better than the hybrid.
Yeah, in some ways. I mean, I like that vehicle, too, though. I like some of the things it does. They've done a few things differently. The fact that, you know, the electric authority goes up quite a bit higher, and, yeah, you can't drive from zero to a high speed in full electric mode. But I like some of the stuff those do. I mean, at the end of the day, a diesel is just a vehicle. You know, you don't get any screens. You know, there's none of that geeky stuff that some of us really enjoy, you know.
The one thing that I did appreciate in the Touareg Hybrid is that in most hybrids, if you're in pure electric mode, when the engine comes on, you can feel a little shudder in the car. Not so in the Touareg. I couldn't tell if the engine was on or not unless I was watching the tach.
Right.
And that was pretty impressive. There was zero feedback.
And the same can pretty much be said for the Volt. I don't know if your experience was that way or not, but if there's traffic and if, you know, the radio's on, it's very hard to hear when that thing first fires after your 40
when it first fires
miles.
Up, right. Yeah. You can't hear it on even with the radio off.
No, if you're climbing a mountain and it's gone to 4,800 RPM, there's no getting away from it. Right. But usually, I mean, let's face it, people aren't going to climb mountains in this thing very often. And to just drive around in town, you know, that thing it really stays out of your way. You know, you really don't notice it much.
The only thing I noticed is if you really floor it, you'll hear the engine come on, but there's a lag. So the car will start accelerating on the batteries. Boom, then the engine will come on, and you will hear it. You don't feel it, though. That's what was – they did a very good job of isolating
this
the vibration.
This is, after the battery is depleted.
Yes.
There's so many people still think that it's like a Prius hybrid where if you want full power, why, then the engine has to turn on. No, it doesn't.
Well, it'll be interesting because in the free republics of Sacramento and San Francisco – where the electric minions are eagerly awaiting, where it's very hilly and challenging. It'll be interesting.
But you go up the hill, you give it, and you go down the hill, you get it back. You know, in driving around San Francisco, you know.
Yeah.
It's, let's go to Loveland. Okay, now we need to push the mountain mode button, you know.
So what else do you drive that you can talk about?
I can talk about just about, I drove the Leaf, too, and that was very interesting going back to back.
Yeah, how was that, Leaf and the Volt?
There's pros and cons to either one. And the Leaf is, I didn't realize this before, it's a taller vehicle than the Volt. It's got to be half a foot taller.
Yeah, but inside it isn't because all that stuff is underneath the floor.
It is, but it's got a lot more headroom than the Volt does.
In the back seat, my feet just felt like they were up way too high and not much.
You're sitting on your tailbone. There's no thigh support, right. And but as a result of that, there's bigger glass area in the Leaf. So the cockpit, you're sitting more upright, which I happen to prefer, and it's airier and lighter. But the Volt is sportier. You're sitting lower, and because they put those batteries down low, they lowered the CG versus what a regular car would have. So it actually handles better than the Leaf.
If it had decent tires. And the tires just squeal like crazy at pretty modest, you know.
I think people are going to be surprised when they start seeing Volts in the flesh on the road because they look good.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing that a lot of the other Car of the Year jurors for North American Car of the Year were saying, a lot of them felt that the Leaf just looks goofy.
Okay.
They didn't, you know.
Well, it's a little bit clown car-ish. There's no question about it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious now, they had how many jurors out there?
About 25.
How many Leafs?
They had one Leaf.
Just one?
Right.
And were they allowing you to only go like 2 miles in it? Or?
No, you could take it out and do whatever you wanted.
Because, I mean, what is the real range of that thing?
Well, that's a great question.
Because that 80-mile deal, I think, is LA4, right? I mean,
And LA4 is what?
It's a driving cycle that's antiquated and quite out.
Easier than the EPA cycle?
I think. Yeah, I'm
what
pretty
sure.
What
do you call FTP 75?
Right, and so LA 2000, I think, is one that people are saying is a lot. And the Volt people say, you know, they did their 40 miles on an LA 2000 or something more like that. And sure enough, we did find that several of us got, you know, we drove this far and it said we had this far left, and that would have been 40, you know, if you didn't go the whole way. 40, is, you don't have to be a super hyper miler to get 40. I mean,
In the Volt.
In stop and go traffic and so forth. If you're on the highway, well, it's a little slightly different. But yeah, that's the thing, you know. The Leaf, you know, 80 miles, maybe more like 60.
If it's only 60.
I mean, I drove a Mini E the other day, and I don't know if there was something wrong with it, but I plugged it in for 13 hours overnight. And when I turned it on in the morning, it said I only had a half a charge. It told me I'd have 50 miles. It was 43 degrees out, so I had the heater on. And by the time I drove 7 miles to work, it was down to like 20 miles range. I thought, this is not a viable piece of transportation.
Work. That doesn't work.
You know?
Well, one of the things that they got to do on the Leaf is recalibrate what your range is, because I think the engine or the the gauge recalibrates itself, it seems like every 10 feet. So if you floor it, you know, you go from a 90-mile range to like a 60-mile range, boom, in no time. Yeah. And then you back off a little bit and it comes back up. So
they need some hysteresis.
They need to let you drive a little bit farther before they...
Average a bit longer window than the last 14 seconds.
So what else did you drive?
Let's see. I drove the Nissan Juke, which everybody hates from a styling standpoint. It looks like it's got radiation blisters on its face.
I actually don't hate it. I appreciate the weirdness of it.
It grew on me a lot at SUV of the Year. The whole thing, the whole car.
I enjoyed
driving
it.
I thought, this is ridiculous.
The package.
But the fact of the matter is, it's the most fun small car Nissan builds.
Yeah.
You know,
with the turbo on it, I mean, and it's a real good blend.
And torque vectoring rear axle on the four-wheel drive model. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, this is really fun stuff.
So, yeah, I thought...
No room in it. Can't put anything in the back. Can barely sit in the back seat. I mean, it's a pitiful package. But as Nissan's Mini, you know, with all-wheel drive and whatever, hey, you know.
Yeah, that was a surprise to me because I thought it would be... chintzier than it was. It actually came off reasonably good.
And you can't talk about driving the Explorer, but the look of the Explorer, it looks good on the...
Well, I don't know. There's definitely a strong family resemblance between the new Explorer and the Taurus. You know, when you see the two cars, you go, oh, you know, this is brother and sister and brother and brother or sister and sister, whatever it is. But there's a real tie in there. But I still think Ford's got a chunkiness look to them. They've got thick sections. They've got high belt lines. And it's not that they're ugly in any way, but I just think they're missing something that, you know, as we've talked about before, Joel Piskowski, their new exterior designer, I'm sure he's going to be working on the next generations of them. But the interior of the Explorer, very nice.
Pretty good package.
They teamed up with Sony. So the, you know, the center stack and everything, very classy, very high tech, very nicely done. And yeah, I can't talk about the driving it or anything because that's embargoed until mid-December or something like that. Let's see. I also drove what else that came off at
me. They
didn't
bring a Durango out there, did they?
No, there were no Durangos out there.
I passed one on the drive down here. That has a pretty nice presence on the road, too. I haven't been in one either, but...
Right, yeah. I haven't even seen what they look like yet.
I sat in one today. They had one... I went down to build a V6 Pentastar engine, and they had one there because it's powered by that, but...
I drove... I had a very interesting experience. I drove the Hyundai Sonata Hybrid. And I thought, okay, I'm driving this thing, and it's... I looked at the fuel economy, and it's the instant readout is going somewhere between 40 and 50 miles per gallon, but you can't watch the gauge and drive at the same time. So then I look at the average fuel economy, and it was 31.6.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know, I think I can beat the fuel economy with the regular standard base Sonata GLS. So I grabbed one of my fellow jurors and I said, you take the hybrid, I'm going to take the GLS. Let's zero them out, zero out the fuel economy gauge. I'm going to follow you. You drive however you want, wherever you go, but I'm just going to tail you. Not right on your ass, but, you know, so we drive the exact same roads, about the exact same speeds. So we get back to where we're staging all the cars. He got 33.3 miles per gallon in the hybrid. I got 37.2 in the non-hybrid. And whoa!
Yeah, we had one of those at our Car of the Year thing too, and I just thought it was pitiful. The little displays, which are, let's face it, half of what you pay for. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're a geeky guy buying a hybrid, were ridiculous, dumb. Nothing as interesting and innovative as the fusions. And then, yeah, you've just got a regular 6-speed automatic. It just, that is not a very astute hybrid solution that they've worked
and
out.
It's surprisingly, because, you know, Hyundai's been doing so good, and this is a lithium-ion battery pack, not nickel metal hydride, so it should be the next step forward. It felt like a very heavy car.
Yeah.
And then I got in the Sonata Turbo, and oh my God, what a fun package that is. Don't treat it as a performance car, really. Just treat it as, like, instead of getting the 4, you got the 6. But it's like, I told the Hyundai guys, it's like, it's like a fine wine. It's finally matured to just the right taste. And I really like the turbo.
A 2-liter turbo that runs on a regular gas. That's mm-hmm. pretty nice. Yeah, 273 horsepower, whatever it is.
It feels good.
Piece of work.
The suspension, everything. I really like that car, but they got to go back to the drawing board with their hybrid. And remember, too, this is a hybrid that's kind of weird in the sense that it gets better highway fuel economy than city. And the roads that we were driving on should have absolutely favored this hybrid because we were not doing stop-and-go driving. This was two-lane country road, twisty bits and everything like that, where you're getting a little bit in and out of the throttle. It should have absolutely put a shining halo on this hybrid. And I beat it with the non-hybrid, and not by a little bit.
I'm with you, though. I really think the sweet spot on that one might be the base motor, the DI24. I'm driving one to Florida this Thanksgiving. I'm really looking forward to that. It should be interesting.
Well, you know, if you're on a flat road, you can get 40 miles to the gallon on the highway with that, you know, at 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So that's pretty impressive. Then the other thing that I found interesting, because I was talking with one of the Mazda PR guys, Jeremy Barnes, and I'm very interested in this Sky Active is this brand name that they're putting on all their super efficient engines and diesels and all that. And you probably know a lot about this, Frank, but they're bringing a diesel to the U.S. probably in 2012. That doesn't need any urea injection.
And that's not, I don't think, you know, that in itself isn't that impressive because under 2 liters, which I believe that
No, is, it's a 2.2.
2.2,
very close to that 2-liter mark, right.
Around there.
You can get away with that.
Yeah, and low, it's the lowest compression ratio of any diesel.
14 to 1, that's very low.
So that combination, you know, it's not that amazing to get away with it. What they end up doing is you dissociate a little bit of diesel fuel. So they squirt a little extra in there, too, I presume. I haven't dug too deep into it. But that helps regenerate the NOx cat. Does kind of the job that urea is used for in the bigger ones, where you can't do that enough to make it work. So I presume that's what they're doing. I don't know for positive sure. But, yeah, that one and then the 14-to-1 on the gas motor, too. I'd kind of love to know if it's the same block. You know, could...
No. That's a good question. Well, one of the things that they told me is that by lowering the compression ratio in the diesel, you can then, you know, downsize everything. Because with an 18 or 19-to-1 compression ratio, you need big solid block, big solid crank, big solid rods, blah, 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 blah. They've all downsized.
I still wonder if the diesel, you know, ignition events aren't higher pressure. And you might still need a, you know, sturdier lower end for the diesel version. I don't know.
It's lighter. It's not as light as the gas engine.
Right.
But one of the points is they go down the same assembly line, you know, at the engine plant.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're building, and that's a little bit unusual to build both diesel and gasoline going down the same line. So that's all to the good. But, and that 14-to-1 compression ratio in a gasoline engine.
That's heavy duty.
That's impressive. And in the Demio, which in the Japanese market, it's not sold here, on the Japanese driving cycle, we were just talking driving cycles, you know, LA or FTP and all that. The Japanese driving cycle's pretty easy. But anyway, this car with this gas engine gets 70 miles to the gallon. You would not get that on our driving cycle. But the point is, it beats the Honda Fit hybrid. So, you know, here we're talking about, you know, the regular old piston engine, gasoline-fueled, spark-ignited engine just keeps getting better and better and better.
We've said this for months. The ICE has a long way to go.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
A long way to go. We are going to be having ICEs for many, many years.
And they're going to look pretty like they do now. I mean, an Opak may pop in here in a niche thing and a Scuderi maybe, but... The normal kind of, maybe with HCCI, the diesel-like gasoline cycle, maybe with, you know, a few of these other, you know, I was just talking with Bob Lee, the, you know, the engine a guru at Chrysler today, and he was talking about they're working on a DOT thing with a dual fuel thing where you use a little bit of diesel fuel to aid with the ignition and so forth, and you stay out of the realm where they make bad particulates and whatever, and runs mostly on gas. And there's a lot of neat tricks still to be pulled out of the sleeves here.
Well, I still remember a conversation I had a few years ago with some GM engine guys. And I was asking them, you know, what about hybrids? What about electrics? What about fuel cells? And they said, you know, just take a hybrid as an example. It's a $4,000 additional cost to make a hybrid out of a car.
Yeah.
They said, just give me $1,000 and let me put $1,000 in my engine and let me show you what I can do with it. Mm-hmm. I thought, man, that's a great point, because you add $1,000 to an engine, man, you can do a lot.
Yeah.
And still come out $3,000 cheaper than going the hybrid route.
Yeah. Laser ignition. I mean, there's just any number of cool ideas out there just waiting to happen.
Well, this is probably a good point to bring in our guest for today's show. Kevin, come on up and join us here. And joining us right now, folks, is Kevin McMahon from the Martech Group. So great to have you here on AutoLine After Hours.
So great discussion. I love you here talking about diesel.
Yeah. So tell us what the Martech Group is.
We're a technical and scientific marketing research company, and we work for industry globally, light duty, heavy duty, on-road, off-road, and have done quite a bit of work for the Automotive Alliance and the whole rulemaking that's been going on relative to CO2.
Because we've got rules in this country that are so strict. Because I keep getting mail all the time. I swear to God, every single week, I get at least one email that says, why don't they build diesels in this country? Why don't we have diesels like they do in Europe? And I've just stopped answering them, because so many times I've said, because Europe has easier emission standards than we do. Not that they're a breeze, and not that their engines
are... And a fuel price deck stacked in the diesel's favor both.
It is. But all,
some countries.
Yeah, but all I'm saying is that if... And tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, Kevin, because you're the expert in this. But if we backed off just on NOx emissions a little bit, couldn't we take out massive cost in certifying diesels in the U.S. market?
Absolutely. You back down on the NOx requirements, and you would save hundreds and hundreds of dollars per vehicle. You guys were talking about NOx after treatment earlier. SCR systems on bigger engines, LNTs on smaller engines.
What's LNT?
Lean NOx trap. Hmm. Which is regenerated with diesel fuel, which is more CO2 you're throwing at the problem. Yep. So it's an economic question, but there's not going to be any reduction in NOx standards in this country.
No, so there isn't.
Forget about that idea.
Now, then you can talk about emission standards going forward from here. We had Tom Kowalewski, the head of BMW North American Communications here a month or two ago or something like that. He said he thought that they were starting to get some traction, especially in California, of NGOs, you know, non-governmental organizations, environmentalists, and even rulemakers starting to say, yeah, maybe we should be paying more attention to diesel. Do you get that sense at all?
Well, I would say that there's a camp in the environmental movement that absolutely does not want any competition to the preferred solution, which is one you've been talking about earlier.
Electric.
Correct. And so, therefore, anything that might interfere with that, even if it, when you come down to saying, well, what are the real-world emissions versus the test cycle emissions? What about when you're going 80 on the freeway versus if you're going on a 1973 FTP cycle that is woefully out of date? What about vehicles in this country are certified using Indylene, pure gasoline, and that's what's on the sticker. Now we're going E15, so that's another 5% off in real-world fuel economy. So there's a lot of issues out there, but I would say that in general, they're talking about LEV 3 in California, which is the next round, which is going to bring it down even more, and then the U.S. is probably going to follow. EPA will probably follow in a couple, 5 or 6 years. So that's what they're talking about is, will California leave some room in their next round of tightening such that, all diesels don't have to be certified at the exact same bin as the cleanest gasoline engine.
And then one of the things, and key reason why I wanted to have you on the show tonight is you found out that the California Air Resources Board, which is essentially the EPA for the state of California, really got it wrong when they were calculating diesel emission standards for off-road trucks. Is that right?
Well, that's right. So it was in the Sacramento papers and San Francisco papers last week, but they made an error, about 350% error on their calculation of the amount of emissions that were associated with non-road or off-road construction equipment.
350% is, that's a massive, massive
weathermen error. Don't get it that wrong.
Right. Well, it was a big mistake, and it's actually the second mistake that the embarrassing moment CARB's had this year. The first one being that some of their particulate matter regulations were backed up by a staff member who did all this epidemiology work, and he had estimated, and the rule was passed on the basis of 18,000 premature deaths per year in California due to diesel particulates. Come to find out that now they're backing down to maybe it's half that many, and the guy who did all the work turned out that he fudged his resume, and he actually has a mail order PhD. So there's a lot of egg on the faces of the political appointed board.
Like we say, you can't make this stuff up. The CARB is, I think, one of the worst things out there to affect this business. I mean, California has gone off the rails. They've gone to the point where, well, we have a lot of viewers from California. I have a lot of friends out there, a lot of enthusiasts, and they say, don't lump me in with what's going on in Sacramento, because they are living in a parallel universe that bears no rhyme or reason to any sort of rational thought whatsoever. And now we're seeing the manifestations of that when they make crucial mistakes and make legislation based on those mistakes. And then this whole thing about Washington, you know, hand-wringing in consort with California. I mean, it's just a train wreck. And it's costing us money, competitiveness, everything.
So what's happened since the news came out that they made this big mistake? Is the CARB backing off their regulations?
Yeah, they've backed down quite a bit because they're under extreme pressure. I mean, the construction industry in California, who was going to foot the bill to the tune of billions of dollars in the case of this regulation. So this regulation covers all existing equipment in the field, not just forward equipment, but all the old stuff.
Yeah.
And as you guys know, a backhoe or a crane can be 25 years old and be in its prime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way that equipment, which is extremely expensive. So the regulation said all that existing equipment has to be retrofitted or disposed of early or sold out of state or out of the country. And so that was the rule. So it affected 165,000 pieces of equipment that were covered.
Who caught this mistake?
Well, Sierra Research, which is a great company out there in Sacramento, and they're a technical analysis firm. It's pretty much a CARB watchdog. And they do all these analytics to examine their rules and the basis of their rules and the justification of their rules. So, as you guys know, in the world of regulatory affairs, everything has to be proven on a cost-benefit study. And so if you're a regulator that wants to get the right answer, you can try to minimize your costs or you can elevate your benefits. And if you can do both, low cost and high benefits, that's better than, the Lions going to the Super Bowl.
No, it isn't.
So anyway.
We live for that day.
Right.
But it's gonna happen.
That's what happened in this case. So they developed this super ethereal model about how much equipment is used and how what the duty cycle is and how much load is on the backhoe. I mean, down to every piece of equipment. And they came up with this, how much fuel is burned, which leads you to how much is coming out of the tailpipe.
Mm-hmm.
Then the rule is created on that basis, and the billions of dollars in cost are justified by huge amount of NOx reduction and PM reduction. Okay, so then along comes Sierra Research, and they said, wait a minute, isn't there a more direct way to get at this? So the first thing they did was, since it's non-road equipment, they used dyed diesel, so-called dyed diesel, which is does not have road tax applied to it. You guys are familiar with that. So first of all, they tallied up the number of gallons that are not subject to road tax, since it's an off-road regulation. And then secondly, they went to the California like treasurer's office and looked at all the data for construction companies on their tax returns. They take a credit for any of the diesel that they bought commercially that did have tax applied to it. So they took that data from California, and they summed the two together, and they said, well, this is how much fuel is really being used in this kind of equipment. And it's 420 million gallons less than what the basis for the law. So 420 million gallons is like, per year, is like five Saudi Arabian tankers sneaking into L.A. Harbor in the dark of night and unloading with nobody watching. That's how much 420 million gallons a year is.
Come on. Yeah.
Jeez. So has anybody gone back and said, whoa, let's go back and look at some of the basis of other rules that they've written, especially as it applies to diesels?
Well, I think that there's a lot of scrutiny on it. And you know, as everybody knows, the election is coming up here with this, the question of should AB 32, which is the CO2 regulation, should that be put on pause?
Until pending a recovery. Study the underlying science.
Well, right. Now, pending a recovery in the economy. So one side has it that, you know, this regulation is going to drive huge increases in energy taxes and energy costs, and that's going to be bad for job creation in California. The other side says, no, through regulation, we're going to create massive amounts of wealth and job creation with green jobs, and this is our ticket to prosperity. That's what's on the ballot.
Yeah, that second thing you mentioned, those first two words, through regulation. I'm not buying it. We're going to get wealthy. Okay.
We're going to get rich through regulation. Yeah, I don't buy that at all.
Well, if you don't buy it, I mean, that's, as you guys know, that's going on at the federal level, too.
Mm-hmm.
Green jobs and green job, you know, is the basis for what the purported upside is to CAFE rules, to CO2 rules that are now being proffered for the next round. And before we even get to cap and trade and non-mobile source emissions, they're going to be covered under these new rules.
Kevin, you're a guy who studied diesels not just for off-road, but on-road and passenger cars
right.
Specifically. What's your outlook for diesels in the U.S. market going forward here?
Well, diesels today in the U.S. market are outselling as a percentage of sales. The take rate on diesels is well above what the take rate is on the same vehicle that has a hybrid. So Camry hybrid, the take rate is really low. So where you have a choice, either conventional gas and a hybrid or conventional gas and diesel, the percentage of customers on those platforms selecting diesel are way, way higher.
I just wonder, though, if that's really skewed by the Jetta and Golf, right? Which are kind of the only cars in that area. You know, if you want a sort of a small car and it's a diesel, you got to buy that one.
Correct.
And whereas, you know, if you want a small car and it's gas, you got a lot better choices than some of those ones. I wonder if that's skews the, since it's one anecdotal car throwing those numbers off.
Well, the numbers for the Mercedes and BMW applications and Audi now is out. You know, those are all well above 20%.
Oh, in fact, it's on the Audis, I know, because we had Johan Denison in here not too long ago, and he was saying on the A3 and the Q7, the take rate is like 60%.
Right.
So that's pretty good. But Frank raises a good point. You know, you only have a few models of passenger car diesels to choose from. So if you want one, that's where you're going, is to those few models.
Correct. That's why it'll be interesting when Mazda comes out. I heard you talking about Mazda earlier, which will be another mid-sized car, small car that's got a choice.
Yeah, they haven't announced which car it's going in, but my guess is the Mazda 6.
Makes sense.
You know, for a 2.2-liter diesel, that would be ideal in that car, I would think. But do you see any interest in other manufacturers getting into the diesel segment in the U.S. market besides the ones that we've talked about?
Well, Tom Stevens, you heard it at the diesel convention downtown a couple weeks back, made a little bit of a splash by saying that diesel was in the plan for General Motors. So that's been going around for years, that European diesel, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't a 2-liter, wouldn't a 2.2-liter Opel engine be awesome in an X? So we would tend to agree that plans exist, and I think everybody is waiting to see you know, how exactly, you know, is there going to be any change to the way the emissions regulations are finalized? Again, LEV 3, the next round in California. Depending on the outcome of that, you make a business decision on whether or not this path is viable, you know, over one or two or three powertrain cycles. And if you did make the determination that the regulations are going to chase, you know, are going to go on CO2 so far so fast, or that the regulations are going to go on tailpipe beyond the realm of possibility, then you come down and say the only answer that's permitted is electrification.
GM had that super diesel that they shelved for the bankruptcy that everyone was raving about, saying it was the finest diesel built to date.
Is that the diesel that Tom Stevens is talking about? That
he wasn't V6? Specific.
Wasn't the diesel they did, wasn't it a V8?
Yeah, the 4.5.
Yeah, the truck. Correct. And everyone was raving about it, and then they shelved it. I hope they bring it out.
Yeah, no question. That would be pretty good to do. Well, you know, this is probably a good time for us to get to rapid fire. And so, Ben, let's bring up that graphic. Okay, this is where we get to a lot of the questions that we've had come in from our viewers, and let's get started. Somebody have come in. I got to scroll up to the top of the list here. Jim Haynes wants to know, why would someone really put money out for a Fiat dealership in this market with all the questions about Fiat cars being accepted in the U.S. again? And, of course, this refers to the Chrysler dealers getting some Fiat franchises. Peter, why would you put money into a Fiat franchise?
You're just an optimist, glass half full kind of a guy.
And you're hoping the 500 is the next Mini.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
And they go to bed at night and they have dreams of all these multiple Fiats, you know, with or without Chrysler and Dodge badges that will turn their showrooms into love fest. I don't know. I mean, they go there and they got to believe. They sign up and they're just believing that it's going to happen. That's all they got. Really, that's all they got. They like the 500 the way it looks and they say, yeah, maybe. That's all they got.
What about if you believe regulations, as are being discussed, are going to get us to a 60 MPG cafe and the government is going to force the fleet average into a European-sized vehicle average?
Let's see how that plays out.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to say.
It's a long way to go.
I think everyone's going to go, yeah, 62. I want 62 miles per gallon. And then when they see what's in the showroom and what it costs, they're going to hit the roof. But anyway, next one. Alan wants to know, can anyone shed light on the new synthetic oils the OEMs are starting to use and how they compare to Mobil 1, AmSoil, and other popular brands?
Good,
I'm out of my league
good,
on
good
that
question.
One.
How do they?
Yeah.
Because I was wondering that myself. I assume they're better.
I would assume they're cheaper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I...
But...
That's a little too...
I'm sure someone will... should bring Gary back for that. He'd get to the bottom.
He would get to the bottom of that, right. Okay, 007 Mitch W. says, Frank Markets, I'm stupid. I could not understand your column in Motor Trend about the Volt drivetrain. Does electricity turn the wheels or not?
Electricity is always turning the wheels at 70 miles an hour or some speed a little below or above that. Once the battery is completely disconnected, then the engine and the generator are geared to the wheels. But it is a planetary gear set. And so there's, you know, one output and two inputs. So electricity has to be turning the other output. Otherwise, if it wasn't, if there was no electricity, if you'd completely run out of juice, the engine is just going to spin all those gears and the wheels are going to come to a stop. So always there is more electricity. There's a lot of electricity moving the car. You've got a little help, you know, from the generator and motor, you know, and engine set there.
So do I have it right? It's always electric. And if the electric motor crapped out or if you cut the wire to the batteries, the car would come to a stop.
Right. It clearly would. Unless you could, and I said in my thing, unless you MacGyvered some way to stop the sun gear, you know, then the engine could turn the output and move the wheels. But, you know, I don't know how you're going to do that.
So. And isn't this whole controversy really that at highway speed, 70 miles an hour or greater, essentially this is like a lockup converter? So that you do get a mechanical connection between the engine.
I mean, basically, what happens is, you know, in a Prius, the main motor is connected directly to the wheels, a main electric motor, and then the other one, you know, helps out a little bit. On this one, the main electric motor is on one of the other gears, and it gets to a certain point and it's spinning too fast. And so, to slow that one down, they use the generator, which is usually making electricity. They run electricity into it, run it as a motor. So with both of those turning, it slows the main one down. So from 60 or 70 miles an hour to 101, both of those electric motors are working when you're in battery mode. Well, when you're out of the battery, that same generator still needs to come in there at that speed. It's just that now it's clutched to the engine.
Uh-huh.
So, and they save about 15% efficiency by doing it that way.
They do it just to make
it
more efficient.
It's a smarter way. Well, they have to do it anyway. But it works out more efficient that way.
Well, the controversy was that the electrification purists does not want anything but electric, pure electric.
Well, and General Motors stood up and told us that's what it was. Yeah. You know, it's like the guy on Saturday Night Live. It's so funny that you would think smoking is bad for you, you know. It's so funny that you would think that something besides electricity runs this car, you know. I mean, that's what I, every time now you think back on it, that's what you picture. So they kind of duffed the PR on that thing.
Okay, we're past our one-minute answer time frame. George from Brooklyn wants to know, what does Peter think about the Nissan Juke ads during the baseball playoffs?
Bang. I like that one. It's the other one, I don't know. I like the one. You know, we just talked about the Juke. I kind of like it. It's funky. I think the powertrain package is cool. Yeah, it's not for everybody, but, you know, car business, I like weird things once in a while. So, but I do like that ad.
Jay Cujo wants to know, is there anything at the SEMA show that you're looking forward to, like a newfangled Vette or 300C?
No, I'm looking forward to the babes.
I think I think Lingenfelter is going to have a Camaro there with a 69 facade on it, with a chrome bumper and the, you know, the RSSS headlights.
And they've done the Trans Am thing too. Yeah. No, there's always some great stuff.
Yeah, and they've got a chrome bumper applique for the back, so it really turns the, you know, which all looks kind of like a 69 anyway, but they really 69ify it. Now, that'll be there, I think.
I think this one's for you, Kevin. Jason Jadosh, and I know I blew your name again there, Jason. I'll get it right one of these days. Do the emission number crunchers ever factor in the cleaner burning fuels like biodiesel for diesel when calculating emission numbers and how they may change with a change in blends like B20 or more?
Well, for the moment, they are regulating vehicles and vehicle hardware over here and fuels over here. And they're not bringing the two together into any kind of a unified joint calculation of what these do as a system.
But in the regulatory mindset, it makes perfect sense.
In the regulatory mindset, fuels and vehicles are being calculated separately, which includes electrification. So for now, you've seen all this debate about, you know, on a coal-fired grid, are we even better off on CO2? Are we neutral? Are we worse? And that's why you see, you know, a lot of discussion about this. But, you know, specifically to the B20, the great thing about B20 is you give up maybe 1% of the energy density that you have on B0. So you can have low CO2 and a renewable fuel and less petroleum consumption without asking the buyer to give up fuel economy and range like you do on E15, which I said before is going to be 5% down versus E0.
Don't we need to nail that algae thing, though, before the biodiesel really kind of makes sense?
Yeah, but
the algae is a
great idea, and it holds a lot of promise, but we haven't even, we're barely at the pilot stage. It's going to take about a decade before we really, really, truly know. George from Brooklyn wants to know, and Peter, you're going to be the one to ask this to. What does the panel, he says, but I'm asking you, what do you think of Porsche slotting a model between the 911 and 918 Spyder?
I don't know what to think about that. Porsche was mystifying me recently, lately. I don't really have an opinion on that.
Yeah, I don't have any.
And they're awfully distracted by this whole, all the Volkswagen Porsche hijinks right now.
Roaster Jack wrote in to say, is GM going to show the Opel Vivaro commercial van concept or something like it at the Detroit Auto Show?
Probably. Because Ford, they know Ford's got the new Transit Connect is already out.
Is that right?
Over there, and it's coming here. So GM's getting a little nervous because the new Transit Connect is very cool looking. Very cool.
Vivaro's bigger than that, though. That's sort of halfway between that and the
Transit.
And the Sprinter or whatever, yeah.
Well, they also got to be nervous, GM, because Chrysler is looking, or Fiat's looking at bringing the Doblò over here, which is a Transit Connect-sized vehicle.
Yeah. Personally, I think the Vivaro would be a better idea. It's like, all right, that's kind of halfway between the Transit Connect and the Sprinter, and nobody's in that space at the moment. So,
but I think the next-gen Transit Connect is a little bigger.
Okay.
Getting back to that Porsche thing, the thing I don't like to hear is the version of the Volkswagen... What was that concept called? The Blue Sport?
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're going to have a Volkswagen version, a Porsche version, and an Audi version. I mean, pretty soon we're talking GM, you know, reincarnated. And I'm not digging that at all. But I know why they're doing it, because the Boxster's already, you know, they're $60,000, you know.
Right.
But I don't agree with that.
Okay, Juan Barnett says, have you guys read the Auto Extremist's latest rant? Peter is doing a hell of a job. Who'd have thunk it? He has a sense of humor even when limited to 140 characters. Pass on my thanks to him. So we pass on your thanks.
Thanks.
So and then he's got a question. Could you tell me what are the reasons why LPG, he says light petroleum gas, but it's actually liquid petroleum gas, is not popular in the United States as a car fuel? I get that question all the time.
It's like an electric car. To put enough of it on board, I mean, most cars, like a Civic, you can only get like 120 miles or 100 miles. So you have range anxiety. You can't buy it hardly anywhere. So you pretty much gas up at home where you have some fitting on your natural gas thing or whatever. Of course, LPG, you actually got to go someplace else for that. It's really a fleet fuel only.
Korea's going crazy over it. They're starting to really try to push it. But you're right. And same with propane, too. The two issues with them is they're petroleum derived. So if your goal is get off petroleum so we stop importing as much of this stuff, you don't want to go
natural
the LPG.
Natural gas makes some sense. A neighbor of my sister's commutes to Orange County from San Diego every day. They have two of them. They hook them both up at night, and it's cheaper, way cheaper. It's like an electric car. That's all they do with it. You can't go on vacation, you know.
Domestic natural gas.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of
T-Boone Pickens.
T-Boone. That's right. In fact, Kathy Ligocki, who we had on the show this summer, has gone to work for a company that used to be known as V-Vehicle, and now they're calling it, I would blank out on it, something Auto Works or something like that. But it's supposed to be an American-made, very low-cost car, but T. Boone Pickens is one of the big financiers in it, which tells me it's got to run on LPG.
Is that the taxi cab?
I thought they were talking about a retail vehicle, not a taxi.
Okay.
They're talking about a small, fun-to-drive, super-efficient, super-low-cost car.
Okay.
So, but the fact that Kathy Ligocki's involved in it has got me very intrigued. Mike wants to know, the tax on gasoline helps pay for road upkeep. How will the advent of electric cars impact the money going to highway upkeep? Fantastic question.
Before you even get to speculating on how many electric cars we're going to have, the CAFE rules by design are trying to push down the amount of fuel consumed, and they will.
Mm-hmm.
So tax, absent of a rate increase per gallon, dollars being collected every year are going to go down, down, down. So it'll be up to Congress to either increase the fuel tax rate or come up with a new way to fund the
road. Well, CAFE isn't really affecting over-the-road trucks, and don't they shoulder a heck of a lot of the percentage of the fuel road tax because they just burn tons of fuel. Right now I see those stickers on the back of this vehicle pays X number of dollars a year in tax.
Right. But yeah, still, like, it's still like two-thirds gasoline, one-third diesel.
Yeah.
You watch. It'll be when you go get your license plates, you have to pay a
They'll just change that. Tax. You know, the diesel tax will go up just to make it all.
You'll have to pay a toll to go to your 7-Eleven.
Well, one of the questions, too, or one of the issues being debated is getting off a gasoline tax altogether and going to a miles-driven tax. So you get taxed on how many miles you drive every year.
A little chip in your, a little GPS chip in your head.
Well, you would need some sort of GPS or transponder in your automobile, and there's a big backlash from a civil liberties, big brother standpoint of, I don't want the government tracking how and where
I'm telling you, John, we're going off the grid.
They can just mail you your
speeding ticket. Gone off the grid.
We just need hover cars, and then we don't need any stupid roads.
You're not putting one in my old Maserati. I'll drive that every day.
Right. Okay, Jay Cujo says, and I think this one's to you, Peter, has Chrysler's recent increase in market share in the U.S. begun to change your opinion of what Sergio declared almost a year ago?
No, hasn't changed, because I base all my stuff on what's coming. The grand plan. So, no, I haven't changed my view of Chrysler.
See, I still say Chrysler's going to shock everybody at how well they do. But are they going to hit the market share goals Sergio has said they're going to hit? I don't believe that for a second.
They're doing some really good stuff. I mean, that engine I was working on today, this one engine family is replacing seven other engine family, you know, engine vehicle engines in their
this is
process,
their,
12 different
their Phoenix V6?
Yeah, now Pentastar.
Pentastar right. V6, right.
I don't dispute they got some good things going on, but I think the optimism over the public's automatic acceptance of all of these, this smorgasbord of or Italian buffet of vehicles that are automatically just going to go great guns, I'm just not buying it. I mean, we are live in such a fragmented marketing environment these days. It takes so much money to get these vehicles in front of people. Yeah, you can do social networking and all that, but still, it's a real. He's carved out a huge task.
Hey, we've got some phone calls here, Ben. Why don't we start to bring in some of the calls that we've got here?
John, I love your show. I have one question for you. Scotsman, I haven't seen him on the air recently. Does he have a new baby, and is that why he's not at your show? Thank you so much. This is Frank from Long Island. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, Frank. David Welch hasn't been here in a while, and I haven't seen him actually in weeks now. But yes, they do have a new baby. They adopted a daughter from China. In fact, David had to take 2 weeks off just to go over there, spent a couple of weeks there with his wife, then brought their daughter back here. He says there's been some adjustments and some things, but it's actually going pretty well. He's pretty geeked about how well it's going, as a matter of fact. But then this crazy guy is studying to get an MBA. At the same time, he's got this massive workload at Bloomberg. So he's got his plate full, and we will get him back here. But David's told us his life has taken a turn for the busier, as busy as it was before. And so he'll make some cameo appearances from time to time with us. And Ben, let's bring in another call here.
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan Brown.
All right, Jonathan.
New Jersey. Great show, as always. I do have a quick question for Peter with his auto extremist article. This week he mentions Twitter, which I think is crazy nonsense, but he states the Corvette achieved global respectability but long overdue for a makeover. The C7 can't come soon enough, but it's unlikely to go far enough. And my question to Peter this evening is, what is he basing the fact that the C7 will be unlikely to go far enough, and what aspects is he talking about? And if you could expand upon that for a minute or two, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks again, guys. A great show. Peter, always auto extremist. Awesome.
Thanks, man. I think the C7 package-wise is going to be very similar to the current car. It's going to be slightly lighter, maybe slightly trimmer. But even though it's fanciful right now, when you see something like the Porsche 918, I want to see drivetrain innovation in the C7. I don't think we're going to see any earth-shattering things going on there. And I'm afraid they're not going to reach far enough. Now, remember, the C7 was delayed, what, John? 2 years?
Right.
Because of the bankruptcy?
Right.
And remember, the C6 was delayed 3 years almost. So we're kind of backing up here. So I don't think we're going to see the leap of faith of the C7. Will it be a great car? Yeah, I'm sure it will be. I just want them to kind of skip a generation and do a leap forward, and we're not going to see that. We're not going to see alternative powertrains. We're not going to see electrification. You know, we're just not going to see...
Certainly not going to see a mid-engine.
No, but that's the... That's the Corvette, hardcore Corvette enthusiast lament. Where is the mid-engine?
Last 40 years.
Even if they just build 2,000 of them. Mm-hmm. That you still have the Corvette, but maybe there's this mid-engine supercar to compete with the world's best. It's a legitimate desire.
Well, John DeLorean was working on a mid-engine vet, right? I mean, that's why I said 40 years ago.
I'd be kind of happy if they would make the aluminum chassis now the baseline and maybe do a carbon fiber tub for the ZR1.
Yeah, just
do something wacky.
Show us what you can do.
Right.
You know, as an American car company, put it out there. You know, there's certainly we meet these people every day. We talk to them. We know they're capable of doing anything anyone else is doing. Just go for it. That's, I think, where that comes from for a lot of enthusiasts.
Great. We got a couple more phone calls here, too. Ben, let's bring one in.
Hey, guys. This is Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey. Glad to see the band's almost back together again. Question for you in regards to secession. I'm looking at what's happening with Ford, and obviously Mulally can be there as long as he wants, but, you know, I get the sense he's a guy who likes to fix things, and, you know, who's his successor? And then over on the GM side, from what I can see, you know, the guy who's there now, really, he's a finance guy. He's there to get the IPO up, to make it run as smooth as possible, you know, be there 2 years, maybe, at the most. But, you know, I look at him as another guy who's really just a fixer. Get the basics, everything together. But who's the next guy? I mean, who's the guy that's going to keep this thing going so that 3 years from now we're not back bailing them out again because, you know, there's 3 million jobs at stake or some other number that, you know, whoever wants to pull out. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Thanks, guys.
Bye. Good question. Really a good question.
Well, there's... Four or five guys in the mix to replace Allen. He's not going anywhere anytime soon. But
I think Allen will be there at least another 2 years.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're right. There's at least three, you know,
sure,
red hot, you know, replacements that could take him. Mark Fields,
Joe Hendricks, and Jim Farley.
In fact, I would say this guy Steve O'Dell, who they just put in charge of Europe.
As far as GM goes, nothing would make me happier if they gave Mark Royce the keys to the store and just said, you know what, Mark?
Go at it.
Go at it. Because GM, for once in their life, needs a guy without financial connections to call the shots.
Right. But as I've said, and I'm totally with you, I don't think he's old enough. And I don't think the board's going to give the car keys to a guy who could be there for, what's Mark now, 46, 47?
47.
So, I mean, you know,
yeah, but there's
17 years, that's an awful long... It's just not the model that boards follow these
days.
Yeah,
I know. But there's this thing about, well, you know, you get the keys of the company when you're 60 and you give us 5 years. You know,
right.
I don't think the industry has that kind of time anymore. I think we need the best guy at the position we got. It's like, you know, if you're an NFL team, you know, we just need the best guys on the field we got. And let's worry about all that other stuff later, you know. I wish American business has to go back to that attitude. We're just going for it, you know, and we'll worry about the hand-wringing and the succession and, oh, boy, you know, that means you're going to be chairman for 16 years. That ain't going to make it. You know, I don't know. I don't think they have that kind of time. Nobody wants to see the domestic industry careen off into the ditch again. Nobody.
Well, I agree with you totally. But you're describing what is the ideal that should happen.
Yeah.
I'm saying here's what I think is the reality of what they're going to do.
Yeah, yeah. But and so in that regard, who knows who they're going to...
Right. I think they're going to take a page out of Ford's book and go outside the company. Go look for somebody who they think can fit the bill.
Could be my big calling. I'm ready.
That's right. But I don't know. I think they definitely need to promote Dan Akerson to chairman and get him out of the CEO position.
Well, that's happening, what, December?
Well, I think he's going to keep both positions, chairman and CEO. And I'm saying it's fine if he wants to be chairman.
Yeah, but
they need somebody who knows.
There's nothing good about that chairman and CEO scenario.
No, nothing
good at all.
That is, I totally agree with you. Hey, we got another phone call coming in here. Ben, let's bring this one in.
Hi, John. This is Frank D. from Long Island again, Long Island, New York. I have a question for your guest, Frank. Does he think a $50,000 car is a normal price in this everyday market for everyday people? Because if he does, I'm calling Motor Trend and let them check his salary, because I think he's making too much money. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure where that's coming from. I think the average transaction price is in the $26,000 range.
$30,000. It's $29,000 and change.
$29,000 and change. So, yeah, that's the normal price range. I mean, this is probably some sort of dig at our recent SUV of the year thing, which is $47,000. But it's SUV of the year. It's not, as one of our commenters said, SUV of the year for people without a job. It's what was the best one that came out this year. And hey, the last 2 years it was Subarus that transacted at $30,000, and people yelled at us about those too. So sorry, that's how it goes.
Yeah, and I've been saying all along that by 2015, I believe the average car is going to be $35,000.
Oh, I absolutely
how many units,
agree.
How big is our industry?
In 2015?
Yeah.
I think it'll be up at 15,000 units.
15 million.
Or 15 million, excuse me.
And if it goes to that high price, what does the average age happen then? Does the world go to a more of a used car base? And cause let's face it, cars will go 150,000, 200,000 miles now to... Does the fleet just get older if they're just so expensive?
Well, we could even step back and get into a complete philosophical discussion in that, and this is what futurists are worrying about right now in this business, and that is that there are hordes of young people out there who don't give a crap about getting a driver's license, but they do give a crap about what the latest version of this is.
Cell phone.
That's right. A fundamental problem with our industry going forward. And we're going to have to figure out how to get those people juiced about. Personal mobility will always be a part of the human emotional connection. People love personal mobility, but we got a whole generation of people who really said, driver's license? Oh, yeah, I guess I got to get one of those. It's bad.
My mom finally made me get one when I was 17,
No, I hear all the time, my son's...
Are you kidding? I started driving when I was 13.
Oh, I
couldn't wait till I could get my driver's license.
I hear these people today, I was 17.
I learned driving
myself.
I thought you were talking about you yourself.
Oh, my God, no. I bought a car at 15, yeah.
I learned car control when I took my sister's Camaro out when I was 14, and we'd go out on a fresh snowfall, so I could just...
That's how you learn how to drive.
Yeah,
get out,
I learned
out of the
car control, slide and the thing. It was awesome.
Four-wheel drift.
Now, it's just like, oh, yeah. Oh, I guess I need to get a driver's license.
I wish I could remember who it was that was explaining to me, and they made such a good point that, when we turned 16, you wanted a car because it greatly expanded your social network.
Yeah.
You could go out and visit your friends, go different places and everything. Now everybody does it with their smartphone or their iPad. And that's how they connect with Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media that's out there. So that's why I think Ford's really on to something, getting out there so much with Sync and incorporating all the social media and connectivity in a car. Because my daughter is the perfect example. We leased her a Ford Focus. you know, while she's still going to school, and she was sort of interested in the car until she found out it had sync in it and that ambient lighting where you can change the interior color, and that was it. That was the, she loves the car because of that, not because of any of the dynamics or anything. Not that the Focus, this is, you know, the current generation Focus has any great dynamics or
what. So these people would be perfect for electric cars.
For all the screens that you're all geeked on.
They're all quiet, and they don't, who cares? It's all about all that crap.
Well, no, they want the guided vehicle thing. You know, when you come into the urban center, you just like, you are now entering the guided vehicle, and you flip a switch and you start, you know.
Texting,
yeah. Reading, whatever. I'm going to this parking structure. Get me there. I don't care.
Well, you know, the problem that
going off the grid, John. Going off the grid.
Right.
Coming out only at night.
Well, you know, but this phenomena of young people who don't care about cars really started in Japan. That's where it's really come.
Yeah.
And I think that's also got psychologically to do with what's going on in Japan, which is a country that economically has gone nowhere for 20 years right now.
Yeah.
They've actually seen their standard of living slowly start to go down.
Yeah, and there was an article in the New York Times about how is this what...
We better pay attention because we could be next on the
list.
Yeah,
we better pay attention to what's going on in Tokyo because, you know, we have all the signs of going right there.
Which is where you're going to want to have a Fiat 500 in your lineup. If you're at a 12 million unit industry and we got unemployment and young people can't afford... You're not going to be selling $35,000 cars. You're going to have to make profits at a much smaller car.
Well, you know, I still think great design and great concepts can overcome all of that and do it very quickly.
Design will be the ultimate initial product differentiator. It'll still sell no matter what it is, pod cars, whatever. Design will rule.
And so when whatever automaker figures out what the millennials are going to get turned on by from a car standpoint, watch out. Because once they go, oh, my God, that's the thing to
cars
have.
Cars that run apps. I mean, that's, you know.
No, it's a car going down the road, and your Facebook page is projected on the side so people can tell you if they want to be your pal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows?
Hey, laugh at what you're saying, Peter.
I'm not laughing.
You're not far off the mark.
Going off the grid, John. I'm going off the grid.
And NHTSA is all over it, as you know. They're looking at
driving
rule.
I'm going to have
they're trying to kill that party before it gets started.
Before there's any more deaths.
I'm going to have a 599 Ferrari in flat black.
That's really hard to keep up, that flat paint, you know.
Yeah, I know. I'm kidding.
I don't like the flat black.
I don't like it at all. I was kidding. I want a black.
I don't know, but the pair of show, there were at least three different automakers that were showing them. And
bad.
It looks like they didn't paint it. It looks like it's in primer. It doesn't work.
And it's really hard. You have to sign papers that say, I'll never wax it. I won't take it to a car wash.
Buff it.
Yeah.
Polish it. Right. It's nuts.
Like they just pulled it out of Elpo and just sold it, huh?
Yeah. No, seriously. Absolutely, Kevin. I don't get it.
No, the black 599 only come out at night.
Yeah. Hey, well, this is probably a great place to wrap up. But, Kevin, thanks so much for
coming on. Thanks for having me,
guys.
Enjoyed it.
Great. And, Frank, great having you here as well.
It's always a pleasure.
Peter, you and I will be back here next week.
Yes, we will.
So, thanks, everybody, for having tuned in. Remember, you can always friend us on Facebook, facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. You can follow Peter at autoextremist.com or twitter.com/autoextremist. Frank, it's probably motortrend.com, right?
That's right.
No Twitter account?
You know, I have a Twitter account, but if you follow me, you're going to be very disappointed.
Not many entries, right?
It's been... at least a year.
Let's just say Frank is giving Ashton a run.
And Kevin, how does anybody find any of yours?
You just call me in Southfield.
At Martech Group.
Correct.
MARTEC.
That's right.
Okay, great. Great having you here.
Preferably on a landline.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.
change of frequency with you.